sanctions varsity baseball in the fall, but only for those schools too small for football. During his career at Asher, it was not unusual for Coach Bowen's teams to win a state title in the fall, then follow it up with another in the spring. During one remarkable stretch, Asher qualified for the state finals 60 straight times, 30 years in a row, fall and spring. In 40 years, Coach Bowen's teams won 2,115 games, lost only 349, hauled home 43 state championship trophies, and sent dozens of players to college and minor league baseball. In 1975, Bowen was named the National High School Coach of the Year, and the town rewarded him by upgrading Bowen Field. In 1995, he received the same award again. "It wasn't me," he says modestly, looking back. "It was the kids. I never scored a run." Maybe not, but he certainly produced enough. Beginning each August, when temperatures in Oklahoma often reach 100 degrees, Coach Bowen would gather his small group of players and plan the next assault on the state playoffs. His rosters were always slim. Each graduating class at Asher had about 20 kids, half girls, and it was not unusual to have a squad of only a dozen players, including an occasional eighth grader with promise. To make sure no one quit, his first order of business was to pass out the uniforms. Every kid made the team. Then he worked them, beginning with three-a-day practices. The workouts were beyond rigorous. Hours of conditioning, sprinting, running bases, drilling in the fundamentals. He preached hard work, strong legs, dedication, and above all, sportsmanship. No Asher player ever argued with an umpire, threw a helmet in frustration, or did anything to show up an opponent. If at all possible, no Asher team ever ran up the score against a weaker school. Coach Bowen tried to avoid weak opponents, especially in the spring, when the season was longer and he had more flexibility with the schedule. Asher became famous for taking on the big schools and beating them. They routinely thrashed Ada, Norman, and the 4A and 5A giants from Oklahoma City and Tulsa. As the legend grew, these teams preferred to travel to Asher to play on the pristine field that Coach Bowen maintained himself. More often than not, they left on a quiet bus. His teams were highly disciplined and, some critics said, very well recruited. Asher became a magnet for serious baseball players with big dreams, and it was inevitable that Ronnie Williamson would find his way to the school. During the summer leagues, he met and became close to Bruce Leba, an Asher boy and probably the second-best player in the area, a step or two behind Ronnie. They became inseparable and soon were talking of playing their senior year together at Asher. There were more scouts, both college and professional, hanging around Bowen Field, and there was an excellent chance of winning the state titles in the fall of 1970 and the spring of 1971. Ron's visibility would be much higher just up the road. Changing schools meant renting a place in Asher, a huge sacrifice for his parents. Money was always tight, and Roy and Juanita would have to commute back and forth to Ada, but Ronnie was determined. He was convinced, as were most baseball coaches and scouts in the area, that he could be a high draft pick the summer after his senior year. His dream of playing professionally was within reach. He just needed an extra push. There were whispers that he just might be the next Mickey Mantle, and Ronnie heard them. With covert help from some baseball boosters, the Williamsons rented a small house two blocks from Asher High School, and Ronnie reported in August to Coach Bowen's boot camp. At first, he was overwhelmed by the level of conditioning, the sheer time spent running and running and running. The coach had to explain several times to his new star that iron legs are crucial to hitting, pitching, base running, making long throws from the outfield, and surviving the late innings of the second game of a doubleheader with a thin roster. Ronnie was slow to see things this way, but he was soon influenced by the fierce work ethic of his pal Bruce Leba and the other Asher players. He fell in line and was soon in great shape. One of only four seniors on the team, he was soon an unofficial captain and, with Leba, a leader. Merle Bowen loved his size, speed, and rocket throws from center field. He had a cannon for an arm and a big power swing from the left side. Some of his batting practice shots over the right field wall were remarkable. When the fall season started, the scouts were back and soon taking serious notes on Ron Williamson and Bruce Leiba. With its schedule loaded with small non-football schools, Asher lost only one game and walked through the playoffs for another title. Ron hit .468 with six home runs. Bruce, his friendly rival, hit .444 with six homers. They pushed each other, both certain they were headed for the major leagues. And they began playing hard off the field as well. They drank beer on the weekends and discovered marijuana. They chased the girls, who were easy to catch because Asher loved its heroes. Partying became a routine, and the clubs and honky-tonks around Ada proved irresistible. If they got too drunk and were afraid of driving back to Asher, they would land at Annette's, where they would wake her up and usually want something to eat, apologizing profusely the entire time. Ronnie would beg her not to tell their parents. They were careful, though, and managed to avoid trouble with the police. They lived in fear of Merle Bowen, plus the spring of 1971 held such great promise. Basketball at Asher was little more than a good way for the baseball team to stay in shape. Ron started at forward and led the team in scoring. There was some interest from a couple of small colleges, but none from him. As the season was winding down, he began receiving letters from pro baseball scouts saying hello, promising to watch him in just a few weeks, requesting schedules, asking him to attend tryout camps during the summer. Bruce Leiba was getting letters too, and they had a grand time comparing their correspondence. Phillies and Cubs one week, Angels and Athletics the next. When the basketball season ended in late February, it was showtime in Asher. The team warmed up nicely with a few walkovers, then hit full stride when the big schools came to town. Ron began with a hot bat and never cooled off. The scouts were buzzing, the team was winning, life was good at Asher High. Since they usually faced the ace of their opponent's staff, Coach Bowen's players saw great pitching every week. With more scouts in the bleachers, Ron proved with each game that he could handle anybody's pitching. He hit .500 for the season, with five home runs and 46 RBIs. He rarely struck out and walked a lot because teams tried to pitch around him. The scouts liked his power and discipline at the plate, his speed to first base, and of course his arm. In late April, he was nominated for the Jim Thorpe Award for the outstanding high school athlete in the state of Oklahoma. Asher won 26, lost 5, and on May 1, 1971, defeated Glenpool 5-0 to win another state championship. Coach Bowen nominated Ron and Bruce Leiba for all-state consideration. They certainly deserved it, but almost took themselves out of consideration. A few days before their graduation, with a drastic change in life facing them, they realized that Asher baseball would soon be behind them. They would never be as close as they had been during the past year. A celebration was needed, a particularly memorable night of hell-raising. At the time, Oklahoma City had three strip clubs. They selected a fine one called the Red Dog, and before heading out, they took a fifth of whiskey and a six-pack of beer from the Leiba kitchen. They left Asher with the loot, and by the time they arrived at the Red Dog, they were drunk. They ordered more beer and watched the strippers, who grew prettier by the minute. Lap dances were called for, and the two boys began burning through their cash. Bruce's father had laid down a strict 1 a.m. curfew, but the lap dances and the booze kept pushing it back. They finally staggered out around 12:30 a.m., 2 hours from home. Bruce, driving his new souped-up Camaro, sped away, but stopped suddenly when Ron said something that upset him. They began cursing each other and decided to settle the matter then and there. They spilled out of the Camaro and began fist-fighting in the middle of 10th Street. After a few minutes of slugging and kicking, both grew weary and agreed on a quick truce. They got back in the car and resumed the drive home. Neither could remember the cause of the fight. It was just one of the night's details, forever lost in a fog. Bruce missed an exit, took a wrong turn, then, very lost, decided to make a long loop on some unknown country roads, heading back, he thought, in the general direction of Asher. With the curfew blown, he was flying across the countryside. His cohort was comatose in the back seat. Things were very dark until Bruce saw red lights approaching rapidly from the rear. He remembered stopping in front of the Williams Meatpacking Company, but wasn't sure what town was nearby. Wasn't sure of the county, either. Bruce got out of the car. The state trooper was very nice and asked if he'd been drinking. "Yes, sir." "Did you realize you were speeding?" "Yes, sir." They chatted, and the officer seemed to have little interest in writing a ticket or making an arrest. Bruce had convinced him that he could drive safely home, when suddenly Ron stuck his head out the back window and yelled something incomprehensible in a thick, slurry voice. "Who's that?" the officer asked. "Just a friend." The friend yelled something else, and the state trooper told Ron to get out of the car. For some reason, Ron opened the door away from the highway, and when he did, he fell into a deep ditch. Both were arrested and taken to jail, a cold, damp place with a shortage of beds. A jailer threw two mattresses on the floor of a tiny cell, and there they spent the night, shivering, terrified, still drunk. They knew better than to call their fathers. For Ron, it was the first of many nights behind bars. The next morning, the jailer brought them coffee and bacon and advised them to call home. Both did with great hesitation, and 2 hours later they were released. Bruce drove his Camaro home alone, while Ron, for some reason, was forced to ride in the car with Mr. Leiba and Mr. Williamson. It was a very long 2-hour ride, made even longer by the prospect of facing Coach Bowen. Both fathers insisted that the boys go straight to their coach and tell the truth, which they did. Merle gave them the silent treatment, but did not withdraw their nominations for postseason honors. They made it to graduation without further incident. Bruce, the class salutatorian, gave a well-honed speech. The commencement address was delivered by the Honorable Frank H.C., a popular district court judge from next door in Seminole County. The Asher High class of 1971 had 17 students, and for all of them, graduation was a significant event, a milestone cherished with their proud families. Very few of their parents had the opportunity to attend college. Some had not finished high school. But to Ron and Bruce, the ceremony meant little. They were still basking in the glory of state titles and, much more important, dreaming of the major league draft. Their lives would not end in rural Oklahoma. A month later, both were named All-State, and Ron was runner-up for Oklahoma Player of the Year. In the annual state All-Star game, they played before a packed house, which included scouts from every major league team and many colleges. After the game, two scouts, one for the Phillies and one for the Oakland A's, pulled the two aside and made them off-the-record offers. If they would agree to a bonus of $18,000 each, the Phillies would draft Bruce and the A's would take Ron. Ron thought the offer was too low and declined. Bruce was beginning to worry about his knees, and he too thought the money was low. He tried to squeeze the scout by saying he was planning to play for 2 years at Seminole Junior College. More money might persuade him, but the offer stood. A month later, Ron was selected by the Oakland Athletics in the second round of the free agent draft, the 41st player chosen out of 800, and the first picked from Oklahoma. The Phillies did not draft Bruce, but did offer him a contract. Again he declined, and headed to junior college. Their dream of playing together professionally began to fade. Oakland's first official offer was insulting. The Williamsons had no agent or lawyer, but they knew the A's were trying to sign Ron on the cheap. He traveled alone to Oakland and met with team executives. Their discussions were not productive, and Ron returned to Ada without a contract. They soon called him back, and on his second visit he met with Dick Williams, the manager, and several of the players. The A's second baseman was Dick Green, a friendly sort who showed Ron around the clubhouse and field. They bumped into Reggie Jackson, the unabashed superstar, Mr. Oakland himself, and when Reggie learned that Ron was the team's second-round pick, he asked what position he played. Dick Green needled Reggie a bit by replying, "Ron's a right fielder." Reggie, of course, owned right field.
"Man, you're gonna die in the minors," he said as he walked away.
And with that, the conversation was over. Oakland was reluctant to pay a large bonus because they projected Ron as a catcher, but had yet to see him catch. Negotiations dragged on, with little money being offered. There were discussions at the dinner table about going to college. Ron had verbally committed to accept a scholarship from the University of Oklahoma, and his parents pushed him to consider that option. It was his one chance for a college education, something that could never be taken away. Ron understood that, but he argued that he could always do college later. When Oakland suddenly offered him $50,000 as a signing bonus, Ron just as suddenly grabbed the money and forgot about college. It was big news in Asher and Ada. Ron was the highest draft pick ever from the area, and for a brief period the attention had a humbling effect on him. His dream was coming true. He was now a professional baseball player. The sacrifices by his family were paying off. He felt led by the Holy Spirit to get things right with God. He went back to church, and in a Sunday night service walked to the altar and prayed with the preacher. Then he addressed the congregation and thanked his brothers and sisters in Christ for their love and support. God had blessed him. He indeed felt lucky. As he fought back tears, he promised to use his money and talents solely for the glory of the Lord. He bought himself a new Cutlass Supreme and some clothes. He bought his parents a new color television. Then he lost the rest of the money in a poker game. In 1971, the Oakland Athletics were owned by Charlie Finley, a maverick who'd moved the team from Kansas City in 1968. He fancied himself a visionary, but acted more like a buffoon. He delighted in shaking up the baseball world with such innovations as multicolored uniforms, ball girls, orange baseballs, an idea with a very brief life, and a mechanical jackrabbit that hauled fresh baseballs to the home plate umpire. Anything for more attention. He bought a mule, named it Charlie O, and paraded it around the field and even into hotel lobbies. But while he was hogging the headlines with his eccentricities, he was also building a dynasty. He hired an able manager, Dick Williams, and put together a team that included Reggie Jackson, Joe Rudy, Sal Bando, Bert Campanaris, Rick Monday, Vida Blue, Catfish Hunter, and Raleigh Fingers. The A's of the early 1970s were, without a doubt, the coolest team in baseball. They wore white cleats, the first and only team to do so, and they had a dazzling array of uniforms, different combinations of green, gold, white, and gray. California cool, with longer hair, facial hair, and an air of nonconformity. For a game that was by then over 100 years old and demanded that its traditions be worshipped, the A's were outrageous. They had attitude. The country was still hung over from the 1960s. Who needed authority? All rules could be broken, even in such a hidebound place as pro baseball. In late August 1971, Ron made his third trip to Oakland, this time as an Athletic. A member of the club, one of the boys, a star of the future, though he'd yet to play a game as a professional. He was well received, got the pats on the back and the words of encouragement. He was 18 years old, but with a round baby face and bangs down to his eyes, he looked no more than 15. The veterans knew that the odds were stacked against him, as they were for every kid who signed a contract, but they nonetheless made him feel welcome. They'd once been in his shoes. Less than 10% of those who sign pro contracts make it to the big leagues for just one game, but no 18-year-old wants to hear it. Ron loitered around the dugout and the field, hung out with the players, took in pre-game batting practice, watched the rather thin crowd file into Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. Long before the first pitch, he was led to a prime seat behind the A's dugout where he watched his new team play. The following day he returned to Ada, determined more than ever to breeze through the minors and crack the show at the age of 20. Maybe 21. He'd seen, felt, absorbed the electric atmosphere of a major league ballpark, and he would never be the same. His hair got longer. Then he tried to grow a mustache, though nature failed to cooperate. His friends thought he was rich, and he certainly worked hard to give that impression. He was different, cooler than most folks around Ada. He'd been to California. Throughout September, he watched with great amusement as the A's won 101 games and clinched the American League West. Soon, he'd be up there with them, catching or playing center, wearing the colorful uniforms, long hair and all, part of the hippest crew in the game. In November, he signed a contract with Topps Chewing Gum, giving the company the exclusive right to exhibit, print, and reproduce his name, face, photo, and signature on a baseball card. Like every boy in Ada, he'd collected thousands of them, saved them, swapped them, framed them, hauled them around in a shoebox, and saved his coins to buy more. Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Yogi Berra, Roger Maris, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, all the great players with the valuable cards. Now he would have his own. The dream was rapidly coming true. His first assignment, though, was Coos Bay, Oregon, Class A in the Northwest League, far from Oakland. His 1972 spring training in Mesa, Arizona, had not been remarkable. He'd turned no heads, caught no one's attention, and Oakland was still trying to figure out where to play him. They put him behind the plate, a position he did not know. They put him on the mound, simply because he could throw so hard. Bad luck hit late in spring training. His appendix ruptured, and he returned to Ada for surgery. As he waited impatiently for his body to heal, he began drinking heavily to pass the time. Beer was cheap at the local Pizza Hut, and when he grew tired of that place, he drove his new Cutlass over to the Elks Lodge and washed things down with a few bourbon and Cokes. He was bored and anxious to get to a ballpark somewhere, and for some reason, he wasn't sure why, he found refuge in booze. Finally, he got the call and left for Oregon. Playing part-time for the Coos Bay North Bend Athletics, he had 41 hits and 155 at-bats, an unimpressive average of .265. He caught 46 games and played a few innings in center field. Late in the season, his contract was assigned to Burlington, Iowa, of the Midwest League, still Class A ball, a lateral move at best, certainly not a promotion. He played in only 7 games for Burlington, then returned to Ada for the off-season. Every stop in the minor leagues is temporary and unsettling. The players earn very little and live off meager meal money and whatever generosity the host club might offer. At home, they live in motels offering bargain monthly rates or cluster in small apartments. On the road, along the bus routes, it's more motels and bars and nightclubs and strip joints. The players are young, rarely married, far away from their families and whatever structure that gave them, and so they tend to keep late hours. Most are barely out of their teens, immature, pampered for most of their short lives, and all are convinced they'll soon be making the big bucks playing in the big ballparks. They party hard. Games start at 7 p.m., over by 10. A quick shower, and it's time to hit the bars. Staying out all night, sleeping all day, either at home or on the bus. Drinking hard, chasing women, playing poker, smoking grass. It's all part of the seedier side of the minors. And Ron embraced it with enthusiasm. Like any father, Roy Williamson followed his son's season with great curiosity and pride. Ronnie called occasionally and wrote even less, but Roy managed to keep up with his statistics. Twice he and Juanita drove to Oregon to watch their son play. Ronnie was suffering through his rookie year, trying to adjust to hard sliders and sharp curveballs. Back in Ada, Roy received a phone call from an A's coach. Ron's off-field habits were of some concern. Lots of partying, drinking, late nights, hangovers. The kid was being excessive, which was not that unusual for a 19-year-old in his first season away from home, but perhaps a strong word from the father might settle him down. Ron was making calls, too. As the summer wore on and his playing time remained marginal, he became frustrated with the manager and staff and felt he was being underutilized. How could he improve if they left him on the bench? He chose the risky and seldom used strategy of going over the heads of his coaches. He began calling the A's front office with a list of complaints. Life was miserable way down in A-ball. He simply wasn't playing enough, and he wanted the big shots who drafted him to know all about it. The front office had little sympathy. With hundreds of players in the minors, and most of them miles ahead of Ron Williamson, such calls and complaints quickly wore thin. They knew Ron's numbers and knew he was struggling. Word came down from the top that the boy needed to shut up and play ball. When he returned to Ada in the early fall of 1972, he was still the local hero, now with some California edges and affectations. He continued his late-night routines. When the Oakland A's won the World Series for the first time in late October, he led a boisterous celebration in a local honky-tonk. "That's my team!" he yelled repeatedly at the television while his drinking buddies admired him. Ron's habits changed suddenly, though, when he met and began dating Patty O'Brien, a beautiful young lady and former Miss Ada. The two quickly got serious and saw each other regularly. She was a devout Baptist, drank nothing, and didn't tolerate bad habits from Ron. He was more than happy to clean up and promised to change his ways. In 1973, he found himself no closer to the big leagues. After another mediocre spring in Mesa, he was reassigned to the Burlington Bees, where he played in only 5 games before being transferred to the Key West Conks of the Florida State League, Class A. In 59 games there, he hit a dismal 137. For the first time in his life, he was beginning to wonder if he would make it to the big leagues. With 2 very unimpressive seasons behind him, he had quickly learned that professional pitching, even at the Class A level, was far more difficult to hit than anything he'd seen at Asher High School. Every pitcher threw hard. Every curveball broke sharper. Every player on the field was good. Some would make it to the big leagues. His signing bonus had long since been spent and wasted. His smiling face on a baseball card was not nearly as exciting as it had been only 2 years earlier. And he felt as though everyone was watching him. All his friends and the fine folks of Ada and Asher were expecting him to fulfill their dreams, to put them on the map. He was the next great one from Oklahoma. Nicky cracked the show at 19. Ron was already behind schedule. He returned to Ada and to Patty, who strongly suggested that he find meaningful employment in the off-season. An uncle knew someone in Texas, and Ron drove to Victoria and worked several months with a roofing contractor. On November 3, 1973, Ron and Patty were married in a large wedding at the First Baptist Church in Ada, her home church. He was 20 years old, still a prospect as far as he was concerned. Ada saw Ron Williamson as its biggest hero. Now he'd married a beauty queen from a nice family. His life was charmed. The newlyweds drove to Mesa for spring training in February 1974. A new wife added pressure to finally make his move up, maybe not to AAA, but at least to AA. His contract for 1974 was with Burlington, but he had no plans to go back there. He was tired of Burlington and Key West, and if the A's sent him back to those places, then the message was clear. They no longer considered him a prospect. He pushed harder in training, ran more, took extra batting practice, worked as hard as he had back at Asher. Then, during routine infield practice one day, he made a hard throw to second base, and a sharp pain shot through his elbow. He tried to ignore it, telling himself, as all players do, that he could simply play through it. It would go away, just a little spring training soreness. It was back the next day, and worse after that. By late March, Ron could barely toss a ball around the infield. On March 31st, the A's cut him, and he and Patty made the long drive back to Oklahoma. Avoiding Ada, they settled in Tulsa, where Ron got a job as a service representative with Bell Telephone. It wasn't a new career, but rather a paycheck while his arm healed, and he waited for some baseball person, someone who really knew him, to call. After a few months, though, he was doing the calling, and there was no interest. Patty got a job in a hospital, and they went about the business of getting themselves established. Annette began sending them $5 and $10 a week just in case they needed help with the bills. The little supplement stopped when Patty called and explained that Ron was using the money for beer, something she did not approve of. There was friction. Annette was worried because he was drinking again. She knew little, though, of what was happening in the marriage. Patty was very private and shy by nature and never really relaxed around the Williamsons. Annette and her husband visited the couple once a year. When Ron was passed over for a promotion, he quit Bell and began selling life insurance for Equitable. It was 1975, and he still had no baseball contract, still no inquiries from teams looking for neglected talent. But with his athletic confidence and outgoing personality, he sold a lot of life insurance. Selling came naturally, and he found himself enjoying the success and the money. He was also enjoying late hours in bars and clubs. Patty hated the drinking and couldn't tolerate the carousing. His pot smoking was now a habit, and she detested it. His mood swings were becoming more radical. The nice young man she'd married was changing. Ron called his parents one night in the spring of 1976, crying and hysterical with the news that he and Patty had fought bitterly and separated. Roy and Juanita, as well as Annette and Renee, were shocked at the news and hopeful that the marriage could be saved. All young couples weather a few storms. Any day now, Ronnie would get the phone call, get back in a uniform, and resume his career. Their lives would be on track. The marriage would survive a few dark days. But it was beyond repair. Whatever their problems, Ron and Patty chose not to talk about them. They quietly filed for divorce on the grounds of irreconcilable differences. The separation was complete. The marriage lasted less than 3 years. Roy Williamson had a childhood friend named Harry Brickeen, or Harry the Cat, as he was known in his baseball days. Both had grown up in Francis, Oklahoma. Harry was scouting for the Yankees. Roy tracked him down and passed along his phone number to his son. Ron's powers of persuasion paid off in June 1976 when he convinced the Yankees that his arm was fully healed and better than ever. After seeing enough good pitching to realize he couldn't hit it, Ron decided to play to his strength, his right arm. It had always caught the attention of the scouts. Oakland had continually talked of converting him to a pitcher. He signed a contract with the Oneonta Yankees of the New York Penn League, Class A, and couldn't wait to get out of Tulsa. The dream was alive again. He could certainly throw hard, but oftentimes had little idea where the ball was going. His breaking stuff was unpolished. He'd simply not had enough experience. Throwing too hard, too quick, the soreness came back, slowly at first, then practically a full-blown limpness. The 2-year layoff took its toll, and when the season was over, he was cut again. Again avoiding Ada, he returned to Tulsa and sold insurance. Annette dropped by to check on him, and when the conversation shifted to baseball and his failures, he began crying hysterically and couldn't stop. He admitted to her that he had long, dark bouts of depression. Once more accustomed to life in the minors, he fell into his old habits, hanging around bars, chasing women, and drinking a lot of beer. To pass the time, he joined a softball team and enjoyed being the big star on a small stage. During a game on a cool night, he fired a throw to first base, and something snapped in his shoulder. He quit the team and gave up softball, but the damage was done. He saw a doctor and put himself through a strenuous rehab program, but felt little improvement. And he kept the injury quiet, hoping once again that a good rest would have things healed by spring. Ron's final sally into professional baseball came the following spring, in 1977. He again talked his way into a Yankee uniform. He survived spring training, still as a pitcher, and was assigned to Fort Lauderdale in the Florida State League. There he endured his final season, all 140 games, half of them on the road, on the buses, as the months dragged by and he was used as sparingly as possible. He pitched in only 14 games, 33 innings. He was 24 years old with a damaged shoulder that wouldn't heal. The glory of Asher and the Merle Bowen days were far away. Most players get a sense of the inevitable, but not Ron. There were too many people back home counting on him. His family had sacrificed too much. He'd bypassed college and an education to become a major leaguer, so quitting was not an option. He had failed at marriage, and he was not accustomed to failure. Plus, he was wearing a Yankee uniform, a vivid symbol that kept the dream alive every day. He gamely hung on until the end of the season. Then his beloved Yankees cut him again. Chapter 3. A few months after the season was over, Bruce Leiba was casually walking through the South Roads Mall in Tulsa when he saw a familiar face and stopped cold. Just inside Topper's Menswear was his old pal, Ron Williamson, wearing very nice clothes and peddling the same to customers. The two bear-hugged and launched into a lengthy session of catch-up. For two boys who'd practically been brothers, they were surprised at how radically they'd drifted apart. After graduating from Asher, they went their separate ways and lost touch. Bruce played baseball for 2 years at a junior college, then quit when his knees finally gave out. Ron's career had not fared much better. Each had notched one divorce. Neither knew the other had been married. Neither was surprised to learn that the other had continued a fondness for the nightlife. They were young, nice-looking, single again, working hard with money in their pockets, and they immediately began hitting the clubs and chasing women together. Ron had always loved the girls, but a few seasons in the minors had brought an even higher intensity to his skirt chasing. Bruce was living in Ada, and whenever he passed through Tulsa, it was time for an all-nighter with Ron and his friends. Though the game had broken their hearts, baseball was still their favorite topic. The great days at Asher, Coach Bowen, the dreams they'd once shared, and old teammates who'd tried and failed just like them. Helped mightily by two bad knees, Bruce had managed a clean break from the game, or at least the dreams of Major League glory. Ron had not. He was convinced he could still play, that one day something would change, his arm would miraculously heal, someone would call. Life would be good again. At first, Bruce shrugged it off. It was just the residue of fading fame. As he had learned himself, no star fades faster than that of a high school athlete. Some deal with it, accept it, and move on. Others keep dreaming for decades. Ron was almost delusional in his belief that he could still play the game, and he was greatly troubled, even consumed, by his failures. He constantly asked Bruce what people were saying about him back in Ada. Were they disappointed in him because he had not become the next Mickey Mantle? Were they talking about him in the coffee shops and cafes? No, Bruce assured him. They were not. But it didn't matter. Ron was convinced that his hometown saw him as a failure, and the only way to change their minds was to get one last contract and claw his way up to the major leagues. Lighten up, pal, Bruce kept telling him. let go of the game. The dream is over. Ron's family began to notice drastic changes in his personality. At times he was nervous, agitated, unable to concentrate or focus on one subject before ricocheting to the next. At family gatherings, he would sit quietly, mute-like, for a few minutes, then barge into the conversation with comments only about himself. When he spoke, he insisted on dominating the conversation, and every topic had to relate to his life. He had trouble sitting still, smoked furiously, and developed the odd habit of simply vanishing from the room. For Thanksgiving in 1977, Annette hosted the entire family and covered the table with her traditional feast. As soon as everyone was seated, Ron, without a word, abruptly bolted from the dining room and walked across Ada to his mother's house. No explanation was given. At other family gatherings, he would withdraw to a bedroom, lock the door, and stay by himself, which, though unsettling for the rest of the family, did allow them some time for pleasant conversation. Then he would burst out of the room, ranting about whatever happened to be on his mind, always a subject completely disconnected from what everybody else was chatting about. He would stand in the middle of the den and rattle on like a madman until he got tired, then dash back to the bedroom and relock the door. Once, his rowdy entrance included a guitar, which he began strumming furiously while singing badly and demanding that the rest of the family sing along. After a few disagreeable songs, he gave up and stomped back to the bedroom. Deep breaths were taken, eyes were rolled, then things returned to normal. Sadly, the family had become accustomed to such behavior. Ron could be withdrawn and sullen, pouting for days over nothing or everything. Then a switch would flip on, and the gregarious personality was back. His baseball career depressed him, and he preferred not to talk about it. One phone call would find him dejected and pitiful, but during the next, he would be hyper and jovial. The family knew he was drinking, and there were strong rumors of drug use. Maybe the alcohol and chemicals were causing an imbalance and contributing to the wild mood swings. Annette and Juanita inquired as delicately as possible and were met with hostility. Then Roy Williamson was diagnosed with cancer, and Ron's problems became less important. The tumors were in his colon and progressing rapidly. Though Ronnie had always been a mama's boy, he loved and respected his father, and he felt guilty for his behavior. He no longer attended church and was having serious problems with his Christianity, but he clung to the Pentecostal belief that sin gets punished. His father, who led a clean life, was now being punished because of the son's long list of iniquities. Roy's failing health added to Ron's depression. He dwelled on his selfishness, the demands he'd made on his parents for nice clothes, expensive sports gear, baseball camps and trips, the temporary move to Asher, all repaid in glorious fashion with a single-color television set extracted from the signing bonus the A's gave him. He remembered Roy quietly buying second-hand clothes so his spoiled son could dress with the best in high school. He recalled his father trudging along the hot sidewalks of Ada with his bulky sample cases, peddling vanillas and spices. And he remembered his father up in the bleachers, never missing a game. Roy underwent exploratory surgery in Oklahoma City early in 1978. The cancer was advanced and spreading, and the surgeons could do nothing. He returned to Ada, rejected chemotherapy, and began a very painful decline. During his final days, Ron drove home from Tulsa and hovered over his father, distraught and tearful. He apologized repeatedly and begged his father to forgive him. Roy, at one point, had heard enough. "It's time to grow up, son," he said. "Be a man. Stop all the crying and hysterics. Get on with your life." Roy died on April 1st, 1978. In 1978, Ron was still in Tulsa and sharing an apartment with Stan Wilkins, an iron worker 4 years his junior. The two had a fondness for guitars and popular music and spent hours strumming and singing. Ron had a strong, untrained voice and promising talent with his guitar, an expensive Fender model. He could sit and play it for hours. The disco scene was hot in Tulsa, and the two roommates went out often. After work, they'd have a few drinks, then head for the clubs where Ron was well known. He loved the ladies and was utterly fearless in his pursuit of them. He would survey the crowd, pick out the hottest woman, and ask her to dance. If she agreed to dance, then he usually took her home. His goal was a different woman every night. Though he loved to drink, he was careful when he was on the prowl. Too much booze might hamper his performance. Certain chemicals, however, did not. Cocaine was roaring through the country and widely available in the clubs in Tulsa. There was little thought given to sexually transmitted diseases. The biggest concern was herpes. AIDS had yet to appear. For those so inclined, the late 1970s were wild and hedonistic, and Ron Williamson was out of control. On April 30, 1978, the Tulsa police were called to the apartment of Liza Lynch. When they arrived, she told them that Ron Williamson had raped her. He was arrested on May 5th, posted bail of $10,000, and was released. Ron hired John Tanner, a veteran criminal defense attorney, and freely admitted to having sex with Lynch. He swore it was consensual. They'd met in a club, and she'd invited him back to her apartment, where they eventually went to bed. Tanner actually believed his client, a rare occurrence. To Ron's friends, the idea of rape was ridiculous. Women practically threw themselves at him. He could take his pick in any bar, and he wasn't exactly stalking young maidens at church. The women he met in the clubs and discos were looking for action. Though he was humiliated by the charges, he was determined to act as though nothing bothered him. He partied as hard as ever and laughed off any suggestion that he was in trouble. He had a good lawyer. Bring on the trial. Privately, though, he was frightened by the process, and for good reason. To be charged with such a serious crime was sobering enough, but to face a jury that could send him to prison for many years was a terrifying prospect. He kept most of the details from his family. Ada was 2 hours away. But they soon noticed an even more subdued personality, and even wilder mood swings. As his world became gloomier, Ron fought back with the only tools he had. He drank more, kept even later hours, chased even more girls, all in an effort to live the good life and escape his worries. But the alcohol fueled the depression, or maybe the depression required more alcohol. Whatever the combination, he became moodier and more dejected, and less predictable. On September 9th, the Tulsa police received a call regarding another alleged rape. An 18-year-old woman named Amy Del Ferniehuff returned to her apartment around 4 a.m. after a long night in a club. She was feuding with her boyfriend, who was in the apartment asleep with the doors locked. She couldn't locate her key, and since she really needed to find a restroom, she hustled down the block to an all-night convenience store. There, she bumped into Ron Williamson, who was also enjoying another late night. The two did not know each other but struck up a conversation, then disappeared behind the store and into some tall grass where they had sex. According to Ferniehuff, Ron struck her with his fist, ripped off most of her clothes, and raped her. According to Ron, Ferniehuff was mad at her boyfriend for locking her out of their apartment and agreed to a quick roll in the weeds. For the second time in 5 months, Ron posted bail and called John Tanner. With two rapes hanging over his head, he finally throttled back on the nightlife, then went into seclusion. He was living alone and talking to virtually no one. Annette knew a few of the details because she was sending money. Bruce Leba knew very little about what was happening. In February 1979, the Ferniehuff rape went to trial first. Ron testified and explained to the jury that yes, indeed, they had had sex, but it had been by mutual consent. Oddly enough, the two had agreed to have relations behind a convenience store at 4 in the morning. The jury deliberated for an hour, believed him, and returned a verdict of not guilty. In May, another jury was impaneled to hear the accusations of rape by Liza Lynch. Again, Ron gave a full explanation to the jury. He had met Lynch in a nightclub, danced with her, liked her, and she evidently liked him, because she invited him back to her apartment where they had consensual sex. The victim told the jury that she decided she didn't want to have sex, that she tried to stop it long before it got started, but she was afraid of Ron Williamson and finally gave in to keep from being hurt. Again, the jury believed Ron and found him not guilty. Being called a rapist the first time had humiliated him, and he knew the label would stick for many years. But few people got tagged with it twice, and in less than 5 months. How could he, the great Ron Williamson, be branded as a rapist? Regardless of what the juries said, people would whisper and gossip and keep the stories alive. They would point at him when he walked by. He was 26 years old, and for most of his life he'd been the baseball star, the cocky athlete headed for big league glory. Later, he was still the confident player with a sore arm that just might heal itself. People in Ada and Asher hadn't forgotten him. He was young. The talent was still there. Everybody knew his name. It all changed with the rape charges. He knew he would be forgotten as a player and would be known only as an accused rapist. He kept to himself, withdrawing more each day into his own dark and confused world. He began missing work, then quit his job at Topper's Menswear. Bankruptcy followed, and when he'd lost everything, he packed his bags and quietly left Tulsa. He was crashing, spinning downward into a world of depression, booze, and drugs. Juanita was waiting, and she was deeply concerned. She knew little about the trouble up in Tulsa, but she and Annette knew enough to be worried. Ron was obviously a mess. The drinking, the wild, nasty mood swings, the increasingly bizarre behavior. He looked awful. Long hair, unshaven face, dirty clothes. And this was the same Ron Williamson who had enjoyed being so stylish and dapper, who sold fine clothes and had always been quick to point out that a certain tie did not exactly match the jacket. He parked himself on the sofa in his mother's den and went to sleep. It wasn't long before he was sleeping 20 hours a day, always on the sofa. His bedroom was available, but he refused to even walk into it after dark. Something was in there, something that frightened him. Though he slept soundly, he sometimes jumped up screaming that the floor was covered with snakes and there were spiders on the walls. He began hearing voices but wouldn't tell his mother what they said. Then he began answering them. Everything tired him. Eating and bathing were enormous chores, always followed by long naps. He was listless, unmotivated, even during short stretches of sobriety. Juanita had never tolerated alcohol in her house. She hated drinking and smoking. A truce of sorts was reached when Ron moved into a cramped garage apartment next to the kitchen. There he could smoke and drink and play his guitar and not offend his mother. When he wanted to sleep, he drifted back to the den and crashed on the sofa, and when he was awake, he stayed in his apartment. Occasionally the moods would swing, his energy would return, and he needed the nightlife again. Drinking and drugs, chasing the ladies, albeit with a little more caution. He would be gone for days, living with friends, bumming money off any acquaintance he ran into. Then another shift in the wind, and he was back on the sofa, dead to the world. Juanita waited and worried endlessly. There was no history of mental illness in the family, and she had no idea how to handle it. She prayed a lot. She was very private and worked hard to keep Ronnie's problems away from Annette and Renee. Both were married and happy, and Ronnie was her burden, not theirs. Ron occasionally talked of finding a job. He felt rotten for not working and supporting himself. A friend knew someone in California who needed employees, so, much to the relief of his family, Ron went west. A few days later, he called his mother crying, saying he was living with some devil worshippers who terrified him and wouldn't allow him to leave. Juanita sent him a plane ticket, and he managed to escape. He went to Florida and New Mexico and Texas looking for work, but never lasted more than a month. Each brief trip away exhausted him, and he crashed even harder on the sofa. Juanita eventually convinced him to see a mental health counselor, who diagnosed him as manic depressive. Lithium was prescribed, but he wouldn't take it regularly. He worked part-time here and there, never able to keep a job. His only talent had been in sales, but in his current state, he was in no condition to meet and charm anyone. He still referred to himself as a professional baseball player, a close friend of Reggie Jackson's. But by then, the locals in Ada knew better. Late in 1979, Annette made an appointment with the district court judge, Ronald Jones, at the Pontotoc County Courthouse. She explained her brother's condition and asked if the state or the court system could do anything to help. "No," Judge Jones said. "Not until Ron became a danger to himself or to others." On one particularly good day, Ron applied for training at a vocational rehabilitation center in Ada. The counselor there was alarmed at his condition and referred him to Dr. M.P. Prosser at St. Anthony Hospital in Oklahoma City, where he was admitted on December 3, 1979. Trouble soon began when Ron demanded privileges that the staff could not provide. He wanted far more than his share of their time and attention, and acted as though he was their only patient. When they did not comply with his wishes, he left the hospital, only to return a few hours later and ask to be readmitted. On January 8, 1980, Dr. Prosser noted, "This boy has demonstrated rather bizarre and sometimes psychopathic behavior. Whether he is manic, as the counselor in Ada thought, or a schizoid individual with sociopathic trends, or the reverse, sociopathic individual with schizoid trends, may never be determined. Long-term treatment may be required, but he does not feel he needs treatment for schizophrenia." Ron had been living in a dream since early adolescence, since his glory days on the baseball field, and had never accepted the reality that his career was over. He still believed that they, the powers that be in baseball, were going to come get him, put him in the lineup, and make him famous. "This is the real schizophrenic part of his disorder," Dr. Prosser wrote. "He just wants to get in the ball game, and preferably as one of the stars." Long-term treatment for schizophrenia was suggested, but Ron would not consider it. A complete physical exam was never completed because he was uncooperative. But Dr. Prosser did observe a healthy, young, muscular, active, ambulatory man, in better trim than most persons his age. When he could function, Ron peddled Raleigh Home Products door to door through the same Ada neighborhoods where his father had worked. But it was tedious labor. The commissions were small. He had little patience with the required paperwork, and besides, he was Ron Williamson, the great baseball star, now going door-to-door hawking kitchen products. Untreated, unmedicated, and drinking, Ron became a regular at the local watering holes around Ada. He was a sloppy drunk, talking loud, bragging about his baseball career, and bothering women. He frightened many people, and the bartenders and bouncers knew him well. If Ron Williamson showed up to drink, everyone knew it. One of his favorite clubs was the Coach Light, and the bouncers there watched him closely. It didn't take long for the two rape charges in Tulsa to catch up with him. The police began watching, sometimes following him around Ada. He and Bruce Leba were bar hopping one night and stopped to fill their car with gas. A cop followed them for a few blocks, then stopped them and accused them of stealing the gas. Though it was nothing but harassment, they narrowly avoided being arrested. The arrests, however, began soon enough. In April 1980, 2 years after his father died, Ron was jailed on his first drunk driving charge. In November, Juanita Williamson convinced her son to seek help for his drinking. At her prodding, Ron walked into the Mental Health Services of Southern Oklahoma office in Ada and was seen by Dwayne Logue, a substance abuse counselor. He freely admitted his problems, said he'd been drinking for 11 years and doing drugs.